Hi, my name is Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this podcast, we discuss subjects that might be creepy to some, and sometimes even frightening. Some of our episodes will deal with serious subject matter, while others will be more lighthearted. Please keep in mind that I am not an expert on any of the topics I cover, just an interested party, and as always, listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone and welcome back. I'm Danielle.
I'm Paul-Emile.
And you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. Tonight's episode is the second part of our two-parter episode about the Chafia family murders. If you haven't listened to last week's episode, it would be a good idea to go back and have a listen to it because we were picking up in the middle of the story. When we ended the episode last week, we had learned about the Chafia family and the troubles that were going on inside the home. Three of the daughters, Zainab, Sahar, and Gidi, were rebelling against the strict and controlling household. Rona, who was Mohammed Shafia's first wife, was telling family members about abuse that was taking place in the household and how her life had become unbearable. Social workers had been called to the house numerous times, but no action had been taken to remove the children. So it's now June 13th, 2009. Ahmed and Mohammed were returning together to Montreal from a trip to Dubai, according to a 2016 Maclean's article. The family met at the airport, and by all accounts, Mohammed actually seemed to be like a different person almost. Zainab was there, basically she wanted to ask him for his forgiveness for all that she'd done, for insisting on marrying Amar, and by all accounts, Mohammed forgave her. And I think that's kind of what he wanted them to feel. He wanted them to feel like everything was okay, so no one would run away again, not rocking the boat, just trying to keep things calm for now. Shortly after they returned from Dubai, the family purchased a used Nissan Sentra, and all 10 members of the Chafia family took off for a road trip to Niagara Falls. They split themselves between two vehicles, so the newly purchased Nissan Sentra and the family's Lexus SUV. For the family members who were not in the family's good graces, it almost felt like Mohammed Chafia was relaxing his rules a little bit, like things were maybe getting a little bit better.
Actually, it seemed like it was giving them a little bit of freedom by letting them drive in another vehicle.
Right, so just a little leeway. I mean, it might not seem like a big deal, but for an extremely strict family, that might have been a big thing. Now, through this trip, Sahar, who was about 17 years old, spent a lot of time on her cell phone, so the family's movements are pretty well documented because of cell tower pings and different messages. The family reached their hotel room in Niagara Falls in the early morning hours of June 25th. On the 27th, there was a cell tower pinged to Ahmed's cell phone, but instead of being in Niagara Falls with the rest of the family, he was actually in Kingston Mills, which was several hours away.
So there's a red flag, like what's he doing there?
Right, it's just sort of odd behavior. So it looks like he actually backtracked while the rest of the family stayed put. All in all, they spent a couple days in Niagara Falls and checked out of their hotel room on June 29th. At that point, Ahmed had rejoined them. By the time they hit the road, it was already 8 p.m. They would be driving through the night.
Yeah, that's an odd hour to leave for a trip.
It is, especially if you have a family. Like, it's one thing if you're just getting off work or something, but they were on vacation. Like, it's weird. It's weird to me as well, hitting the road at 8 p.m. It is summer, but you still only have, like, 2 hours of daylight left.
Although I recall traveling when you guys were young, and we'd leave, especially when you were infants, like, leave at an odd hour, hoping that you were going to sleep most of the way.
At one point, the family stopped at a rest stop, and one of Tuba's brothers called her. So it turns out that Mohammed had been sharing a plan with friends and family members. This plan included ending Zainab's life. Family members that were far away were very concerned when they heard that the family was going on a road trip to Niagara Falls, so they were calling, kind of checking in, making sure things were okay. Muhammad was not being quiet about his threats towards his daughters. He was informing other people of his plans. In his opinion, his rebellious daughters were dishonoring the family, and he had to deal with it.
So when you say he was telling people, are these people that were living in Canada also, or relatives that were still in the home country?
I think it was mostly people that were overseas, but I don't think it was only people that were overseas. Also, I don't know, you know how sometimes people talk a lot, but don't do anything? I don't know this for a fact. It's not written anywhere, but I'm wondering if Muhammad had been voicing these kinds of thoughts for a long time, so that when he was telling people this, they were just thinking he's mad, he's upset.
Or he's boasting.
It was definitely enough for people to be concerned, but not enough for people to go to authorities, apparently. So what happens from this moment on is kind of speculation. We're not sure. We only have the story from Muhammad, Tuba, and Ahmed. We don't know for certain what happened. But the police believe that after they had pulled over at their rest stop, Muhammad got behind the wheel of the Sentra, carrying Zainab, Sahar, Gidi, and Rona. The rest of the family was in the Lexus. The police believe that when they got to Kingston Mills, they pulled into an area near the locks. Muhammad got out of the Sentra and Tuba got in. They were all told to stay in the car while Muhammad and Ahmed went to look for a motel. So they were going to stop there for the night, still a couple of hours away from Montreal. While the men were checking into the nearby motel, they told the person checking them in that 6 guests would be staying there. Then they corrected themselves. No, it were 8 guests. They seemed to be unsure. Eventually, they settled on 6.
So they already had their plan in their mind that some of the guests were not going to be present.
Right. So I don't even know if I want to think about what the going back and forth meant, if they didn't know who was going to perish, if they hadn't finalized the plan. I don't know. But it is odd, knowing what happens afterwards. The exact events following them checking into the motel are unknown. We know that the next morning, as we mentioned at the beginning of part one, the car, the Nissan Sentra, was found in the locks by the police. Zainab, Sahar, Gidi, and Rona were deceased inside the vehicle. Shortly after the police had discovered the vehicle, Muhammad, Ahmed, and Tuba turned up at the Kingston Mills police station reporting their family members missing. It didn't take very long for the police to realize that the woman and the girls in the vehicle were the missing Shafia family members.
So I wonder, when they reported the family members missing, did they know the police had found the vehicle?
I don't know if they knew. I'm assuming, like, it's not like that spot was hidden. It's not like no one was going to see it. So I'm assuming they knew it would be found pretty quickly. As the police began piecing together the story they were being fed by the family, they didn't feel like the Shafias were being truthful. What had begun as an interview with what they thought was a grieving family quickly turned into more of an interrogation. All 3 family members present at the police station told the officers that they didn't know what had happened to the girls. Tuba told them that once the entire family got to the hotel, Zainab had asked her for the car keys. She thought that Zainab was just getting something in the car, so she gave her the keys. Everyone had fallen asleep. And according to Tuba, when they woke up the next morning, the 4 women were missing.
But knowing the history of the family and how tight of a grip was being kept on those women, it's hard to think that they would have been missing all that time without anybody noticing.
Right. And the other thing is, Zainab didn't have, I don't think any of them had a driver's license. So, I don't know, the whole idea of just giving them the car keys and no one being more concerned than that is odd as well. And the police thought so too. As they're listening to the story, they're really thinking, okay, we're not getting the whole thing here. There's information that's missing. when the family had gotten to Kingston Mills, they'd already been driving for hours. It was really late at night, like the early hours of the next day, really. Why would four of them get into a car together again and drive out after all that time on the road? The police were also suspicious because the Shafias had shown up to the station in a green minivan instead of the Lexus that they'd said they'd been driving during their Niagara Falls road trip. So as they were digging deeper into this, they learned that at 7:55 a.m. that day, Ahmed had called 911 from Montreal to report that he'd gotten into an accident with the Lexus, alone, in a parking lot. He'd hit a pole.
This story is just getting more and more confusing. Like, there's a left in a Lexus, and the Lexus is in Montreal, and they're driving a green minivan. And
Ahmed keeps taking off and leaving the family behind for no reason that they can really explain. Also, like, honestly, I can kind of believe with all the driving he must have done that you could get into an accident alone in a parking lot. Like, I can see being super tired and, like, accidentally hitting something. But calling 911? I don't know if that's just not knowing the procedures, the correct procedures of what you should do if you get into an accident that involves no one but yourself in a pole and you're fine. But it's just very strange. So they believe that once he got into this accident, reported it, he switched vehicles and took the minivan up to Montreal.
Okay, so the minivan came from Montreal and was not a rental.
Sorry, yes. They believe that once the accident happened, Ahmed jumped into the minivan, which was also theirs, and drove from Montreal back to Kingston, picked up the family, and then the family went to report the girls missing.
So my next question is, if they already had two vehicles and a minivan would probably be more comfortable to travel in, why did they buy the Nissan for this road trip?
I don't know why they bought the Nissan, but they already had a second vehicle. Mohammed told the police that he had no idea what had happened to the women. He said that he just woke up in the morning and they were gone. Again, for someone who kept very tight reins on his family, this is strange. So while this is going on, the coroner is doing the autopsy on the victims and found bruising on three of the women's skulls. In all three cases, the bruising was identical, which would be highly unusual in the case of an accident. You would have different types of injuries.
Well, yes, the person sitting behind the steering wheel would have different injuries than the person in the back seat or on the passenger side.
Right. So this really confirmed to investigators that they were looking at a homicide. This was no accident. The police kept questioning the family and kept getting just slightly different versions of the same story. They were never able to clearly answer a lot of the questions that were being posed, like why had Ahmed left? Everyone kind of came up with something different. According to the McLean's article, the police had also found a witness that saw two vehicles head towards the water during that night, but only one vehicle leave. The family denied knowing anything about this. Now, because someone had seen two vehicles head towards the locks, the police took a really close look at the area. What they found were small shards of plastic kind of scattered around. At this point, they knew they had to get their hands on the Lexus to see what kind of damage there was to the vehicle.
So right now, they suspect that the shards of plastic came from the Lexus.
Exactly. They're starting to think, okay, something happened here and that Lexus was involved, and that's why it's not present in Kingston at the moment. They quickly got the Lexus and they examined it and found there was a dent at the front. So in one spot, I saw that it was a dent like on the front bumper, and somewhere else I saw that it was a shattered headlight, but whatever it was, it had broken the plastic into shards. And they also found similar shards of plastic in the trunk of the Lexus, like someone had picked up the pieces. What was really interesting is the pieces that were found in Kingston and the pieces that were found in the back of the car in Montreal fit together like puzzle pieces. So they knew that that Lexus had been in Kingston, where the family had said that they had no idea what happened. So they found pieces from the car in Kingston.
So as hard as they worked to try and cover up whatever it is that happened, they weren't very smart about it.
It's like they either didn't think anyone would care or they'd buy the story at face value. I'm not sure what their thought process was exactly. Just a week after finding the car in the locks, a judge approved wiretaps on the Shafia family. The police set up the wiretaps in the vehicles, and recorded Mohammed cursing his dead family members and basically celebrating their death. He and Touba discussed how it had to be done, and Mohammed says he would do the same thing over again.
No remorse.
At one point, Touba expressed her agreement that Zainab had to be dealt with, but sort of said that the two other ones maybe didn't. And Mohammed disagreed with her, said that they had betrayed themselves and the family and this had to happen. The police arrived at the Shafia residence on July 21st and social services was with them. The remaining children were placed into foster care and a warrant was executed on the residence. The police gathered much more information through the wiretaps and the warrants, and that was enough to lay charges. By July 22nd, Mohammed, Touba, and Ahmed were arrested.
Charges were laid like within less than a month after. So that's a pretty fast turnaround.
Yeah, it looks like by the next day the police knew, and as soon as those wiretaps went in, they got pretty much all the information that they needed. And I don't know if you remember in part one when we were recording, we talked also about Rona writing a lot in a diary. So everything that she was going through, she'd written down. She also talked to family members about overhearing a plan about killing some of them or getting rid of some of them. So I think there was a fair bit of evidence to be found out there. The police don't know exactly what happened that night. Mohammed, Touba, and Ahmed didn't really confess to anything, so they don't know exactly what happened. They think that after the men checked into the motel, they returned to the waiting centra, and somehow they managed to hold the girls underwater one by one and drown them. They did have the head injuries, or three of them did, so possibly they were hit and then drowned. It's not sure. They think that the bodies were then placed back into the car and pushed into the locks. So there was a little lip to get into the water, and they think they popped the car in neutral but couldn't get the car over the lip, so they used the Lexus to push the car in, and that's where the broken headlight or bumper piece would have happened.
You know, it's quite upsetting to think that how much time it took to murder those women one by one. That's a long time, and where are the first three while one is being murdered?
I don't know. So there's some talk that it was really, really late at night, so maybe some of them were asleep and like one of them was brought out and the others didn't realize what was happening. I don't think they found any drugs in their system or anything, but there were three other adults there that were charged with the murder. I don't know if three of them were taken and kind of, I guess, murdered simultaneously. And then the last one, I don't know. Like maybe the last one was told that she'd be fine, she'd be safe, just be quiet. And then they took care of her as well. They killed her as well. The police really don't know. The trial began in October of 2011. And the defense's strategy was that the whole thing was an accident. That the car was accidentally driven into the locks and Ahmed witnessed the whole thing. His only crime would have been not to admit having seen it and not going for help.
But that doesn't make very much sense where the Lexus had hit the Sentra.
Also, how do you explain the head injuries?
Right.
I mean, the story just doesn't hold up. And then all the wiretaps and the information that they got. On the stand, Mohammed wouldn't admit to having killed them, but he did say that they deserved to die. So he couldn't even stop himself from spewing this hatred towards them, but he wouldn't admit to having killed them, just that they got what they deserved, essentially.
Yeah, and it's sad to think that somewhere in the back of his mind was, it's four women, so the police may not take this that seriously.
I never thought of it that way, but that is possible. The defense's strategy didn't work. The verdict came back within 15 hours of the jury deliberating. They were all found guilty of first-degree murder, which is an automatic life sentence. There's a fair bit of detail out there about the trial, so the McLean's article goes into it, and you can find a lot on the CBC website if you're interested in knowing more detail about the trial. But at the heart of the matter was that Rona and those three girls did nothing except to try and live their lives. They were killed for allegedly bringing dishonor to the family. But we have to keep in mind that as a country, we're not free of blame either. Canada failed them as well. Social services should have gotten more involved and they didn't. I don't want to put that blame directly on anyone. Obviously, the system had to change. There was something wrong with the system if they didn't act upon what was happening. I think there's more cultural understanding now than there was back then. I think they didn't take seriously the threat to those girls at the time.
And it's easy to say the dots were all there. Nobody connected them after the fact. But somewhere along the way, somebody has to start putting those dots in place.
Right. So we're sitting here with a full story in front of us, whereas when things like this happen, some people have some parts of the story, but usually not all.
Yes.
I think it also shows, like, I know with social work, you always hear about the caseloads being enormous and the pressure being put on social workers. That's something else that should change. They do a very important job, and I don't think overwhelming them with work is the way to go. I know this can be said for a lot of jobs, but I think that's when, I mean, their job is to protect the vulnerable. And I think we should place more importance on that and more funding towards that so they're actually able to do their jobs properly.
I was involved in that long enough, and the people that were high maintenance were taking up a lot of the workers' times, and the people that probably would have needed help, but because they weren't saying anything or weren't in constant contact with the social worker, were just left off to one side.
And I think social services, in the Fifth Estate interview, they do talk to one of the higher-up people in social services in Montreal, and she does say, like, we did not have the resources, we did not have the understanding to deal with this properly, and now we know more, so we're going to try to do more. So I do think changes took place because of it, and hopefully they'll be able to save other women, other young girls from meeting a similar ending. We have to keep in mind as well that although this in some articles was referred to as an honor killing, it's not recognized as such in Canada. It's murder, and that's all. So this was just murder, plain and simple. It was evil, it was awful, and should be treated as such.
Right.
I didn't know if I was going to include this or not, but it's so sad, and it's one of those things where I want to do something about it, but I wouldn't even know where to start. In 2012, McLean's actually put out an article reporting that Gidi, so she was the youngest daughter, I think she was 13, her grave had the wrong date of birth engraved into it. It was Sahar's date of birth. And there was a bit of a public outcry about this. The girls had suffered a lot in their life and had met a tragic end. She deserved more than that. McLean's wrote an article about it. They interviewed someone in charge. I don't know if it was the cemetery or the church that was basically saying that they just had to wait until spring to rectify the issue because it was winter. But the article I base most of my research on was a 2016 article. And at the end of that one, they stated that her gravestone still had the wrong date of birth on it. I don't know if it's still the case today. I couldn't find any information about whether or not it was corrected. I mean, if anyone knows the answer to that, please reach out through email. I don't know if there's anything anyone can do about it. And I don't know why, but I'd just like to know.
Well, I think that the whole system failed these young girls and the women in life. So the least they deserve in death is being given the respect and dignity that we need to give them.
Yeah.
And if it's something as simple as making sure that the information on their tombstones is correct,
yeah,
it doesn't seem like very much to do for everything they suffered.
Exactly. So if anyone is in the Montreal area and knows this information, please just let us know. If you could reach out by email, I'd appreciate it. So this was a really heavy case.
Yes, it was.
We'll probably do something a little bit lighter next week. I have another big one that I'm working on. I'm actually reading an entire book about it. So that'll come up in a couple weeks. So I do have a few. The next couple weeks, I pretty much know what we'll be covering. But if anyone has any suggestions, anything that they're interested in hearing about, or something that's sort of personal to them that they'd like us to cover, you can reach out to us at crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com. I know I have a few listener suggestions that I haven't gotten to. I have a second part on a case that I did cover that I'd like to release. So if you're listening and you're waiting for me to cover something that we've talked about, I know I'm on it. I'll get there pretty soon. It's just we've got a lot in the works right now, so it'll be coming out. As usual, we're going to be finishing up with our moment of kindness. It's kind of one of those situations where I like to think I'm not the only person who does this, but I was kind of eavesdropping on something that was going on beside me. So I was in line at a store, and beside me there was an older couple in the next line over. And the wife, you could tell, suffered from dementia, and she was getting quite agitated and just wanted to get out of the store. And I could only overhear bits and pieces of what was going on, but the husband was talking to her in a really calming voice, and he was telling her, you know, we're going to be home in a few minutes, don't worry about it, and it's your favorite show on CBC, so when we get in the car, we'll turn that on and you'll get to hear the show. And it really seemed to calm her down, and it was just such a sweet and compassionate moment. And it really made me think about all the caregivers out there and how tiring their work is to care for sick loved ones, and how, I mean, there's no shame if you're not able to do so. Absolutely, people need help when they're in these situations, but just that little moment of seeing him being so kind to his spouse who was suffering and having that ability to calm her right down, I think it was something really, really nice to see. And I just wanted, I guess, to point out that we have these caregivers in our communities, family members that are basically giving their all to someone else, and we need to recognize them.
Yeah, I think we all need to be thankful that some family members are able to do it, but when they're not, there are services available for everybody that are mostly good.
Yes.
And the majority of the people that are working there are very kind people, and they're doing a wonderful job, and hats off to all of them.
So I hope everyone who is listening enjoyed this two-parter. It's the first time we do something like that, and it might come up again for the sort of heavier cases that we cover. If you're interested, you can join our Facebook group or join us on Instagram at Crime and Mystery Canada. And as I mentioned earlier, you can also reach us at crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com. Thanks to everyone who's been listening, and have a good night.
Good night, everybody.